present, we have Senators Al Adams, Lyda Green, and Mike Miller from Fairbanks, and myself, Chairman Taylor. We do constitute a quorum at this time, and we can take testimony. Because we're not in session, we cannot act or move on the bill or amend it at this time. But we can take testimony, which we then will take up again in hearings in Juneau once the legislature is in session. The first person that had signed up to testify here in Sitka today was School Superintendent John Holst. John, if you raise your right hand, I swear to tell the truth. Thank you.
My name is John Holst. I'm Superintendent of School, School District. I have most of you a chance to visit. My capacity is lobbying for educational issues, but today it's a very different issue. But it's much more personal. I've been an school administrator since 1977. I've been a very advocate, a strong advocate for these years. I've felt struggles in some of my own. System somehow. However, the last 4 years I've had kind of fine experience inside shared the same last days in August of 19. Son, is that
Senator Taylor?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. This is Joe down in Ketchikan. John is breaking up horribly down here, and the folks at the hearing on this end are unable to hear him.
Okay, we'll try it again, Joe.
All right, how's this, Joe?
Much better, John. Thank you.
About that. My son was 12 years old. He and I started commercial fishing together. And by the time he was 16, he had saved enough of his own money to go out and buy his own boat, a 36-foot glass boat with a power troll permit. And starting at that age, he began fishing on his own. And I started getting out of the business. And by the time he was 19, he had graduated high school, was, I think, a very successful commercial fisherman. On one of the last days in August in 1991, he was delivering fish to a seafood company in Ketchikan. And in the process of unloading the fish, he had filled one tote full of fish, approximately 450 to 500 pounds of fish, and it was being taken up to the top of the dock. It was at low tide. The deck of his boat was about 18 to 20 feet from the deck of the seafood processing place. He went back after he had filled the tote. He went back to pulling fish out of the ice as he was expected to do to get ready for the next tote coming down. And just before the tote got to the top, it became lodged underneath the deck of the processing place, and the operator who was, it was late in the season, the person that operated all season had been sent back, gone back to college. They had a backup person running it who I believe at that time was gone on break, and so the third person was running it, poorly trained operator. The hook that was holding the two ropes, one on each end of the tote, they had a latch on it to prevent the cable from coming off. That latch was broken. And they were operating with that broken latch. When the tote got stuck underneath the deck, the operator, not being experienced enough to say, watch out below and be careful about how he was going to get loose, started running the cable up and down, trying to get it to come loose. And in the process, one of the two cables popped off of the hook, and the tote, with about 500 pounds of fish in it, swung and spewed the fish, the contents of the tote, all the way across the water and across the deck of his boat. He was on his hands and knees in the ice hold at the time. He was back exposed, and somewhere around 3, 4, or 5 fish hit him. They were cohos in the range of 8 to 10 pounds, and possibly dogs, but probably were cohos. He immediately went to the emergency room of the hospital to get checked out. The Silver Lining, or the company there, sent people down to unload the fish from the reindeer fish from the boat. So, because he wasn't able to do that. He doctored on his back for about 15 months, tried going back to work the next summer. He was out in the boat 1 or 2 days, and he was back in, was unable to do any of the work. Was referred to a surgeon at Dr. Chaplin, a surgeon in Seattle. He worked with him for about 6 months, and then on New Year's Eve, 1992, he had a fusion of his fourth and fifth lumbar vertebrae. Got one of these plates with the screws in the top and bottom that everybody's seen on 60 Minutes. He has one of those in his back. After the surgery, he went through a fairly strenuous time of rehabilitation, and he has been working at trying to get back to work ever since that time. In the process of trying to get the back taken care of, he was assured by the folks at this company that the cost of all the medical and all the stuff would be taken care of. He said, "No, it's our problem. We dumped fish on your back, so just go ahead and get it taken care of." Even when it came time to schedule in surgery in Seattle, the owner of the company personally called the doctor and said, "Go ahead and take care of the surgery. He needs us taken care of, and we'll stand behind it." Within a month after the surgery was completed, he was informed by the company and their insurance carrier that they indeed would not be paying for it. They had not authorized it. And they said if he wanted to settle the claim and sign off on it, they'd pay the hospital bill, the doctor bill. And so from that point on, they refused to make any kind of payment whatsoever. My son tried to get rehabilitated enough to go back to fishing that spring, that summer. He attempted to do that, made an active effort to do it, and after a couple of days just was unable to function because of the movements of the boat, the type of work he had to do. In that fall, he, because he knew he would not be able to make a CFAB loan payment, he was forced to sell his boat, which was akin to you or I selling our firstborn, because this really was his life. And so he sold the boat, paid off the CFAB loan so that he was free and clear and wouldn't get foreclosed, and the boat taken away from him. But there was no progress whatsoever on any of the matters of the medical stuff. He allowed very nearly the 2 years to expire because he really believed that the people at this company who said they were going to take care of him would take care of him. Final analysis, that didn't happen, and just before the 2 years expired, he did get an attorney, and the attorney then filed. And that began a long, arduous course of trying to figure out over the next year and a half what to do. There was little or no attempt on the insurance carrier part, their representative, their attorney, to do anything to get the thing settled at all. And in January of this year, 1995, there was a jury trial in Ketchikan. It lasted 3.5 weeks. It was a liberal arts education for us novices in the legal field, an experience that I would not wish anybody else to have, but was one that has given me a different view of the judicial system. I found it to be not user-friendly to my son or to the rest of his family. The insurance company and their representative did everything in their power to force my son into settling for something less than he should have settled for, simply paying for the old bills and no compensation to take care of any kind of future cost, loss of any income of any sort. When the trial was over, he had received a fairly sizable judgment, in fact, a judgment that was well beyond what had been offered to settle by our attorney on his behalf earlier. In talking with jurors after the trial, I talked to some of myself, and the rest of them were talked to by our attorneys, legal aides. Almost to a person, the jury said they could not understand for the life of them why this had ever gotten to court, because the negligence was absolutely clear, the responsibility was absolutely clear, there was no question about it. And yet, the attorney for the insurance company put on a strong case he could, to bring up all kinds of things that had absolutely nothing to do with this injury whatsoever. Brought in high-priced, expensive experts, alleged experts, from all over the country to make claims that there was all kinds of things wrong with my son, it was his fault. It was just an incredible experience, just an incredible experience. In the final analysis, we're now well over 6 months past the time that the jury verdict came in, which was in early February. And my son is going to be involved on Thursday this week with a settlement hearing with the judge in Ketchikan. So still nothing has happened. And I would not anticipate any kind of settlement. This thing is going to go to the Supreme Court, I'm sure. The attorney and this insurance company have contested everything from every I being dotted and T being crossed all the way through. So So much so that, for instance, an example, just simple harassment. My son's back, of course, bothers a great deal when the weather gets kind of lousy in the fall. And so last October, he went to visit my wife's family in Las Vegas. That's, her entire family lives down there, and to get into a drier climate, some warmth for a few days. Actually, he's intending to go down and stay for about 3 or 4 weeks, knowing that this trial was coming up later on, and he'd have to be back here for that. He was down there about 4 or 5 days, and his attorney called him and said that the attorney for the insurance company was filing in court saying that he was not an Alaska resident, that he was out of state living, mooching off relatives, and that and his attorney told him he had to come back. He had to come back to Sitka right away because he couldn't be out of the state anymore. And so he came back within the next 2 or 3 days and had to pay extra for the airfare and everything else. There was no reason for him to be here, none whatsoever. It was just simply harassment and it's just typical of what has happened through this whole thing for the past 2.5 years. It's been nothing but harassment. It's just beyond comprehension. This bill, and I've read this bill several times over, and I have a copy of the most recent in my pocket here, and I read it again last night. I applaud the concept of trying to do something in a positive way to correct errors and correct problems in the system of tort. But the fact is, this bill is attempting to correct 16 different problems. If you were members of the Transportation Committee and a bill came to you that was going to solve the problems of transportation at airports, boat harbors, ferries, major airlines, float plane operators, and that bill came to you and was going to fix all those problems, you'd throw it out in a heartbeat. It would never see the light of day. Yet, that's exactly what you've done with this bill. You've got a bill that covers personal injury. You've got a bill that covers medical malpractice. You've got a bill that covers product liability, whole broad area. Those bills should have never been, those items should never have been in the same bill. And they should each be judged on their merits, because the great fear is you may come up with a couple of these that is an improvement, but it's going to be almost like a pork tacked into a lot of legislation. There's going to be something coming along that's going to cause great problems. I looked at each one of the sections of the bill. There are a couple things in here that I don't have a problem with. I don't want to speak about the medical malpractice part because I don't know much about that, because that's not where my experience is. But I can tell you, from my experience, the changes in this bill that will change the rules of the game, the rules that are already stacked in favor of the defendant. I mean, clearly, if an insurance company wants to fight a claim and gets what they would term a really good attorney, and I'd term a bottom feeder, somebody who has no sense of morality or right or wrong, but is simply there to defend the insurance company at all cost, if they do that, they can probably win most cases. I just have this feeling that there are insurance companies, and I think my son found one, that make the decision in the back room by the bean counters that, you know, if you get real tough attorneys and harass the client, 95% of the time they're going to settle. My son would have. I mean, if he hadn't had a family, I mean, he lives with us. He's a 23-year-old, lives with his parents now because he's unable to earn a living. He would have settled probably. For nothing, just and probably be eating out of the soup kitchen in Ketchikan right now. He was lucky enough to have a family. And I think a lot of the victims don't have that kind of support. And they end up looking toward the system, you know, to save them and to you. So I think it's real important to realize that the rules of the game are already set up in favor of defense attorneys and the companies. I really believe that. And after watching 3.5 weeks of maneuvering in court and out, and then half a year since that time, I'm convinced that companies make a decision, constant decision. But if we fight them, 95% will settle. 5% will probably fight us, and guess what? If we get a really good, sleazy attorney, we'll probably win half of those too. And then the 2.5% that we end up losing, this really good attorney will use the system and get that judgment probably docked down to about half, which I guess in major major cases is pretty typical. 50% of the actual amount that they it's also interesting to me that the insurance companies and their attorneys, their representatives, are so critical of the jury system of making these decisions. And yet, when it comes time for the case to be just decided, they almost never ask the case to be heard by a judge. They always ask to have a jury. And Robin can tell you why that is. They believe that they can manipulate those people. And all they have to do is find three jurors that will agree with them, will find fault with the plaintiff and the claim, and they're home free. The system is right now rigged on a slant like this, and this bill will tilt it even more in favor of the insurance companies. I think it's going to make the state and people get injured, make the state one that we're not going to be very proud of being a part of. I guess if this experience had not occurred, I would never have these opinions. And I guess I understand why people think that there's a problem. You know, I've heard all the horror cases, the horror stories about the coffee cup that gets spilled in the lap and, you know, $2 million later. You're probably going to have somebody testify during the hearings here during this week as to the particulars of that case. And after I heard the particulars of that case, I understood why the judgment was what it was. And I hope somebody along the line will share that with you. The system of reductions of claims that are too high, settlements that do come in too high, that's all in place, that's taken care of by the judicial system as it goes. I just really urge you, when you make these changes, to do it so very carefully, because what you're doing is going to be very, very, very difficult to undo, and it's going to be done on the back of the people who deserve better than this. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I am familiar enough with the bill that I think I can respond to individual sections of the bill if you'd like me to. You're welcome. Thank you for the time. Thank you for coming to Sitka. Appreciate that.
My name is Reed Reynolds. I'm coming to you as president of the Sitka Community Hospital, as a member of the faculty at Sheldon Jackson College, among which courses I teach is economics of healthcare, and with some 30 years of experience in the healthcare system. First, Senator Taylor, members of the Judiciary Committee, let me thank you also for being willing to come to Sitka on this important bill. I've asked Kathy to give you a little graph that I prepared very roughly that shows in 1955, when I got involved with the healthcare field, the percentage of GNP that healthcare was consuming was something like $4.401 per capita. That graduated to $591 in 1975 and to over $2,800 today per capita. Greater than 13% of our GNP is devoted to health care today. Now, when you analyze that increase in health care costs, which everyone is concerned about, inflation explains a big, big piece of it. Labor costs explains a big piece of it. But malpractice also explains a piece of it. And you have the opportunity in this legislation to take a progressive step in support of reduction of the malpractice cost, hopefully without distorting the appropriate benefits to people that are injured. In particular, our current board has not had the opportunity to review this in detail and take action on it formally. Consequently, I'm speaking to you personally today. I can say that in the past, previous boards have examined the tort reform issue and have supported that, the consensus favoring a tort reform. In particular, I have reviewed the material statute and would support the statute of repose. I am reminded of a case in Indiana where an obstetrician after 20 years was found liable using a current standard for practice that existed 20 years prior to that in the matter of a delivery of the baby. That seems wrong to me. That's Indiana. I will certainly try to. I'm not sure that it will be one. Yes, sir. So the statute of repose, I would support and encourage you to pass. Statute of limitations, the non-economic damages, section 4 and 5. Section 6, I think is very useful. Section 7. I think the collateral benefits section is very smart. Sections 12 and 13 on apportionment of fault, comparative negligence, I think is important to have in this legislation. Uniform Arbitration Act, I think, is very valuable. I'm sure that your committee has considered the panel type procedures that are in effect in some other states, and maybe have given consideration to that. And then on Section 21, civil liabilities for hospitals, back in the 60s, the Darling case, the whole idea of the charitable immunity was reversed, and hospitals began taking on much more responsibility for practice of people that were non-employees. I think this is a step in moderation of the opposite extreme to the charitable immunity that existed prior to that time. In summary, we believe that your legislation is a step in the direction of reducing health care costs, and that's something we all need to do, hopefully without unduly damaging those who properly should have claims and receive reports from the system. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am. Yes,
and
I did.
Could you explain that?
A Darling case occurred in Illinois. It involved, I believe, a high school football player who ended up having his leg amputated, allegedly because of improper care. And up to that point, hospitals were considered immune because of their charitable status. After that point, the hospital was held liable for behavior of some people that perhaps were not employees of the hospital, as I understand the case. I could get that. So.
I believe that in that instance, the hospital was held responsible because the hospital would have continued to grant privileges to the physician. That's our, as a community of people, that's our protection of those facts. People not practicing proper procedures is the hospital itself. If the hospital, now, any shows up, license, did the background check, did the peer review, should be a person.
Well, I don't think in that case there's any question what the hospital was. But it was a mild case, minor case, had it first the tradition that existed up to that point. Since then, hospitals have been responsible. Now, what you're doing, I believe, if I read this correctly, is just moderate that to a certain extent, the trend that has occurred since then. If I understand the bill that's presented. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, but you're breaking up, and the testifier was very clear, but you yourself were broken and very soft here.
Can you hear me clearly now?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
That was my fault. Please forgive me. I hadn't thought to turn this little switch on and off. We'll try and be more careful on that. Thanks again for letting us know.
Thank you, sir.
Next up is Kay Hawks, administrator of the Sitka Hospital. Mr. Hawks.
My name is Kay Hawks. I'm here representing Sitka Community Hospital. Some of the things that have been said here today, now economic damages, I think, are well within this bill, and all of us agree economic damages, no matter what they are, should be paid. I've been in the hospital business. I've been a hospital administrator for approximately 30 years, and in all cases where, in fact, we think a mistake has been made, or an accident has occurred which, you know, might have been prevented or something, we feel those cases should be settled immediately. There should not be a lawsuit. I mean, economic damages should be covered. Non-economic damages, we feel, should be limited. Yes, maybe something should be given for non-economic damage, but there should be a limit. There should be some kind of a statute of limitation on how long people can come back and say, this, you know, you made a mistake. On the other hand, almost every case that I've been involved in 30 years, not for mistakes, they were not for accidents. They were because someone didn't get the results they wanted. And that's going to happen. Medicine is not a science. Medicine, there's mistakes made, you don't always get the results you want. But that doesn't mean anyone did anything wrong. The Jackson Powers case here in this state is a real burden on hospitals because we have been held liable for what someone else does. True, the board appoints these doctors, they give approvals. But at some point, we have to allocate what was our fault from somebody else's fault, not whoever's got the biggest insurance policy is guilty. Because sometimes things do happen. Structured payments, lump sum payments, I think, wrong. That is not going to help the individual per se, at least over any length of time. So I feel we should have some kind of a structured payment so the individual who's injured has a real chance of benefiting any settlement that they make. Because if you give somebody, you know, $100,000 or $1 million lump sum, long-term benefit would be very minimal for that individual, as I've seen in the past. The only hospital that I've been in my 30 years that had a number of lawsuits was a very big hospital. In fact, we had a suit, it seemed like, once a month. We had attorneys that actually would follow ambulances to emergency rooms, hand out cards saying if they didn't feel they got the treatment they should have, could have, that they would handle the case. And in that case, in that particular instance, hospital had to resort to actually countersuing on every suit that was filed. Well, this happened to be in Texas. But I read this bill. I think it's not perfect, but I think it goes a long ways to help correct some of the bad problems that we do have in liability insurance, at least in Medicare. I can't speak to the others, but I do feel that the person, as a citizen, that there needs to be a lot of other areas of malpractice and health and liability insurance. But I am testifying in favor of this, and I think it is a good bill, not a perfect bill. To say that it doesn't need some modification, it probably does. But still, it's going in the right direction. I think that's all we have at this time.
A year or so ago, you and I were talking about cost of medical malpractice insurance. I assume that's the problem that you're referring to. You said the problem of liability insurance.
Well, that is true. Liability insurance over the last 30 years has gone from practically zero, an astronomical figure. Our hospital here in Sitka, a few years back under Mike, was paying, I think it was $127,000 a year. We were running a census, patient census, about 3.5 patients a day. Start adding that up, but you know, you can't include emergency and outpatients. I don't know how to calculate those because of the numbers of them. But it adds up to a fair amount of money that you're paying for each patient you're seeing. This hospital, to my knowledge, has never even handled this. After Mike and now our current insurance rates the last 3 years have come down since Mike went out of business. We are now down to about 96,000, I can't recall exactly, but in that range. So insurance rates have come down. And as you and I talked before, you felt at the time that there was as much problem with the insurance companies as there was with the statute itself. And that's hard to argue with, because insurance companies in a lot of cases make exorbitant profits. I know that. But there's competition, which we did not have in the state of Alaska. That also helps. When we went out and bid, we knocked off $30,000 for insurance. I think
When was that?
3 years ago, when Michael went out of business, NorCal took over. We are not with NorCal. NorCal at that time was just as bad as Michael.
Did you tell me you received a dividend back for Cal?
No, we did not receive a dividend back. Well, excuse me. We got a dividend back from MICA. The reserve funds, not from NorCal, from MICA. And we did get almost a fact that probably was close to a year's premium out of their reserves that they had set aside. They went out of business, so they went back to the hospitals and to the carriers of policy.
How come MICA had money turned back?
Well, all you can really say is reserves were much greater than they would need.
Actually, I think all Senator Green went through the process of terminating MICA.
Yes.
Which had been a response by the state legislature to cover doctors, malpractice carriers, ones that would deserve the state charging exorbitant premiums about 14 years ago.
Yes, I mean, those premiums at that time was much higher than MICA charged. But in the state of Alaska, malpractice suits are really at a minimum in comparison to 48. They had exorbitant prices and built up some huge reserves. I mean, get into your smaller community things, you don't have the lawsuits that you do in large communities. And that's primarily because everyone has personal friends, not only the doctors, but the attorneys, everyone in town knows each other. They're not so likely to sue because they're pretty sure that everything that was done as best that could be done for them.
So you've got your refund back of the Sitka Hospital's portion of the MICA reserve account, profit left after MICA's operation. You got that profit back. You then opened as a bird and as a hospital into a different carrier than NorCal. Right?
Yes, because NorCal was still charging the same premiums at that time as MICA. Since we have another insurance carrier within the state, NorCal's premiums have come down matching, in some cases, are a little bit lower.
What type of percentage of the cost are you looking at just in the past couple of years? You said you paid for 50 years premium hospital?
About 20%, 25% what it was 4 years ago.
Senator Green.
Was the coverage as comparable?
Yes, the coverage is more. Better coverage than we had before. It also includes directors and officer coverage, which we did not have before. And the coverage, the limits are higher.
Just as an aside, Kay, do you know who asked us to terminate MICA?
No, I do not.
Hospital Association and Health Medical Association and all doctors in the state, the reason for it was because of an IRS ruling, MICA was making such significant profits that they were going to have to take the doctor going to have to take that income they were making as a profit into income and pay taxes on it. So when we rolled MICA over and killed it, NorCal buys its assets, and NorCal turns around to the same doctors and says, that average of $70,000 per doctor we would have to pay you, and you would have to pay taxes on it. Instead of doing that, what we're going to do is we're going to give you credit against future premiums that you would owe NorCal by leaving it in the bucket. So the doctors that had that money coming back picked up $70,000 tax-free out of MICA. It must have been a terrible time.
Well, the other thing that did happen, NorCal did offer a credit to the hospitals that would stay with them. We did not stay with them. We felt we would should still be entitled to that credit, but we were not given.
Is that right?
That's correct. NorCal kept that because we did not stay with them.
Okay, thank you very much. Pete Hogren. Here. Just. So.
Hi, I'm Pete Hogren. As of late this week, I've been a lawyer in Sitka for 24 years. And one area that I want to speak about is a section on non-economic damages, 917.010. I sort of sat on the fringes of this question. In the last 10 years, I think I've been involved in two personal injury cases, not as the primary attorney on the plaintiff's side. And the previous 10 years, I was city attorney for the city of Sitka, so I got to be involved not as the primary attorney, but on the defense side on several of these. I would guess in the last 20 years, probably 16 of those years, I have either been the attorney for the city of Sitka Hospital, community hospital, as city attorney, or last 8 years I've sat on the assembly, and I've been assembly liaison for, I think, 6 of those 8 years. So I have watched the hospital and seen both sides of the problem. 0917010 presently, to my way of thinking, has a limit, but it's gutted. It's got a $500,000 limit on non-economic damages, which are basically damages not constituting lost wages or medical costs, which is out of pocket or cost future income. And the way the current statute is worded, I think went into effect in 1988, it said non-economic is limited to $500,000, except that limit does not apply in cases of disfigurement or severe physical impairment. Well, you're not going to find people asking too much money if there isn't some claim of severe physical impairment or disfigurement that possibly leads to death. So I think that the current $500,000 limit is basically not very useful and doesn't. It looks good, but I don't think it makes much difference. HB 158 goes into a great deal of detail, which would actually make the limit, to my way of thinking, reasonable. There's a $300,000 limit for non-economic damages, pain and suffering, that sort of thing. But it goes up to $500,000 under certain types of damages, which are listed with great specificity. By rewriting it, as it's written in HB 158, I believe it sets some sort of semi-objective standard for non-economic damages. Presently, I don't believe that there is any sort of objectivity in the setting of non-economic damages. It's highly subjective. It's based on what the lawyers can basically argue. With the jury, there is a huge amount of uncertainty. Whenever you deal with uncertainty in relations, you raise the cost. I think that's what you're going to find. If you add some certainty here, I think what you're going to find here is you're going to lower auto insurance premiums for the average person. I think it's for owners' premiums, business premiums. And that will be more money in people's pockets. And you have to realize that consumers, when they buy products, are paying an increased cost for that product to cover the insurance premiums on the products. In some areas, it can get quite expensive. You've already heard about what's happening in the healthcare profession. But even buying a ladder has money tacked onto each ladder for personal injury insurance. So that's basically what I look at. I think that at least putting a limit of $500,000 on there gives a semi-objective standard, because you can take all the non-economic damages and you can place them into the $500,000 or $300,000 and let somebody, let a jury sit down and discuss the matter without having some sort of standard. Basically what it boils down to, I think, is on one side you've got the plaintiff's attorney who always think the best way of presenting how much is the loss of an arm worth to you on a daily basis. You know, how much would you pay daily to have that arm back? And you go to a jury with that, you can get up into some extremely exalted figures. So I would hope that you would give serious consideration to instituting the limits on non-economic damages as set out in the HB 158. Thank you.
Go back. Damages. The one for 305. Do you have a set standard you're looking at? Are there, or comfortable? Are you comfortable with the figures in there? Page 3-7 is going to describe the type of accident.
I didn't write this, and I had no input on it. It's the limits seem reasonable to me. The $300,000 is the limit for all non-economic damages except for the ones that are specifically set out in on page 5, which allow $500,000. I feel comfortable with that. I'd also point out that there is a provision D in this bill which says that those amounts will be adjusted annually for the consumer price index so that they will go up based on the inflation rate. I find that a good way to handle things because we do have a number of statutes which get outdated, particularly if inflation goes up.
If you could start with D is consumer price index, started law was enacted perhaps in 1988 when this bill is.
Well, the way the bill is written, it goes into effect for all causes of action arising on or after the date that the bill goes into effect. As I said, in 1988, when the 500,000 limit was put in, I feel that that was, I hate to use the word sham, but I don't think it had a real limiting effect.
Ellis has been with us and is online in the Anchorage LIO. Good to have you here today, John. See you in a couple days. Harlan Knudsen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm Harlan Knudsen. I'm the president of the Alaska Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I'm here this afternoon first to welcome you to Sitka and welcome you back to Southeast, but also to speak in support of House Bill 158 as it arrived from the House of Representatives. I would have to start my testimony by sharing with you one of my keen disappointments in the debate, the excellent debate in the House. All the committees in the House, Judiciary, Labor and Commerce, spent days on House Bill 158. The House of Representatives itself, I think, spent 3 or 4 days. Believe me, I came away from that argument with a great respect for the individual legislators voicing concern on the fairness of House Bill 158. My keen disappointment was, and my plea to this committee, along with a very sincere thanks for holding these hearings, is that I think we failed, particularly from the healthcare side, to explain the problem. Why to hospitals, why to physicians over these many, many years? And I think the debate of tort reform even precedes Senator Taylor. It's been going on for a long time. And why have we in the healthcare community failed so poorly in explaining to the legislature, explaining to the public, what is the problem? Why do we have to change these laws? Now, the first thing is, and I think Senator Taylor and Mr. Hawks brought that out earlier, is the problem is not the availability of liability insurance. That was a problem back in the 70s and 80s, and maybe into the middle 80s. But it is not a problem today. There's a competitive market for liability insurance today. And I think if we've had a little bit of success along the way, it's because there is a competitive market. The second thing is that it's not the cost of insurance. Now, hospitals and nursing homes in the state of Alaska are a $350 million a year business. You add to that the cost of physician services, and then you look at what the annual premiums are, and I think the data that we've seen is that you're spending about $13 million a year in liability insurance premiums on an industry that's somewhere, you know, $350, $400 million. So certainly it can't be just the cost of that, except for the cost of liability insurance to that small rural physician who would like to deliver babies. And there it is, a fact. But overall, so what is the reason that we continually hammer at you and chase my good friend Senator Taylor and say, we have to get you to look at the issue of tort reform? And my two reasons, and I think what I hear the boards and the administrators across the state is, number one, the legal system itself costs too much money. It's very expensive to litigate. It's very expensive to retain lawyers. That expense impacts directly on the cost of health care. I've got some reports that I'll leave with the committee staff, but we come into this business of defensive medicine. How much does the threat of liability, how much costs us in the healthcare system? The second point I want to make is that the system, the legal system, is not only too expensive, but it's unfair. From what we heard in the House of Representatives, there's an awful lot of small liability problems, $100,000 and less, that are never brought to court because there isn't enough money in the legal system to make it pay. If you've got a small injury, you can't generate enough money. There isn't enough there to pay the lawyers to take it to court. And so that you've got a segment of our community being shut out of the legal system. Now, what I would like to do is step back, and I want to give you a little insight as to why the world is so different today than when it was, say, when we debated tort reform in 1992, or we debated it in 1990 or 88 or 76. And the driving force is the cost of health care. One of the major issues in the United States Congress today is to take $270 billion out of the Medicare program. The second major issue is to take something like $186 billion, horrendous amount of money, out of the welfare program. What it means is that, particularly on the Medicaid program, if the caps on Medicaid that the Congress wants to do, they want to remove over the next 7 years somewhere around $560 million out of the federal contribution to Medicaid in this state. So all of a sudden now, where as we came up through the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s, you had a very affluent healthcare system. Today you're seeing managed care. Today you're not going to go pick your doctor. You're going to go pick your health insurance plan, and they're going to tell you what doctor you're going to go to. And they're going to select that doctor not only on the quality of his care, but how much he charges for his care. We're going to see now where we have to look at all the drivers of healthcare costs, and the legal system is one of them. So what I'd like to do is very briefly, the only model that we've got on tort reform is California. And the California components for health or tort reform are contained in House Bill 158. And they start with, as soon as I can find my stuff here, but one of the sections relates to the caps on non-economic damages. This is an extremely tough issue. We're in the caring business, and you've got somebody that's been harmed in the healthcare system and tremendously harmed. Where do you set the limit? Is it $1 million, $10 million, $100 million? How do you set the limits on non-economic damages? You've heard Kay say, let's do everything to take care of the economic side of this thing. But where is the cap? Should you have any cap? We have none now, I guess. We had one, but I guess it's not being used. But the data we get from California and the data of the national studies is if you do a cap on non-economic damages, you can control the cost of care about 23%. If you are open up collateral sources so that you're able to see where that patient, you know, that patient may have industrial insurance, that patient may have Blue Cross, that patient may have several sources. If you open up collateral sources, what impact does that have? Well, it has an impact of about 11 to 18% on controlling your liability costs. Reduced statute of limitations, again, very tough. Who wants to set the statute of limitations on a child? 2-year-old or 4-year-old? But can you have a system with no statute of limitations? And we think eventually you have to make that decision. And if you do that, you've got about an 8% savings. On structured settlement, there haven't really been any tests on that. But it just seems to a lot of folks that if you win a $1 million lawsuit, rather than getting that check, perhaps it should be structured out over a period of time so that you'll have the economic resources that you need. You know, I would hope that during the next 4 days of hearing, and hopefully you'll meet again before the session starts, that you'll ask us in the healthcare community to better define what the problem is. Now, if I may, Senator Taylor, I'd like to go back just for a minute on MICA, because the old issue was the availability of health insurance. And I think the doctors and the hospitals got into the liability insurance with the best of conscience. They really tried to create an insurance company that basically recognized when the provider was wrong, that recognized that if there was harm done, that there had to be settlement. And they tried to price that and treat everybody fairly. And they created a market. And I'll leave with the committee, but there's a good description of what happened to MICA. Well, two things happened to MICA. The first is our friends in the federal government, through about a 1988 or 86 tax reform law, restructured the way the IRS looked at nonprofit insurance companies such as MICA. And what they said under that new federal statute was that you're liable for your reserves. Now, you can call them profits, you can call them anything you want, but you're liable for those. And there was about, I think, about $7.5 to $8 million. And by the time you folks get to Anchorage, we'll be sure that MICA and NorCal people are there. But the second thing that happened that is vitally important was you went from occurrence insurance to claims made insurance. And this is vital now. Up until about 1988 or 90, when you, the reason that you had reserves, because you were on occurrence insurance. And if you had insurance with Aetna or NorCal or MICA or whatever, and you were insured in the year 1986, and if you got sued in 1994, you were still insured because it's based on occurrence. And if you were insured in that year, it occurred in that year, you had insurance for that year. A huge change went on in the commercial and nonprofit physician-owned insurance tort reform or liability company. They moved from occurrence coverage to claims-made coverage. And all that said was, when you buy insurance in 1994 and you pay us, that's, you're only insured for 1994. If that claim is filed in 1996, you're not covered. You have to buy in and have a tail to go back, to take you back to 1994. A whole new concept in insurance. And this is what the reason that MICA had money in the bank, because it was created under a current system. And it had to have money there in reserves because it may get sued 8, 10, 20 years down the road for something that happened. When it, and we moved to claims made about the time that the folks from the IRS were telling us all about you're going to be taxed. And as I understand it, and I would certainly ask the insurance department, but that threat of the IRS tax was much broader than just a state of Alaska-owned insurance company. I think the IRS was stepping back and looking at everything that we're in, including the permanent fund. Now, I don't have that for a fact, but I pass it out as a pretty good rumor. And I think you need to nail, there were some real ramifications there why the state had to get out of the insurance business. So with those two factors, that's why they ended up, NorCal comes in, takes over, buys MICA, and starts to sell claims-made insurance. They don't need any reserves. So all of a sudden, you've got $7.5 million there. Now, they could have been nice and give it to the state, but they said was, we'll give it back to the people who paid the premiums. And that's what they did. And I know the hospital in Juneau got about $500,000 in past premium. So that I think there's some real good reasons why we MICA got out of the business. But that does, I want to quit on making a plea. Are we making any sense that we really feel there's a problem with our tort system? We think it costs too much money. If you have a $1 million lawsuit, $530,000 of that dollar goes to pay for litigation, and $470,000 goes to the injured party. Wouldn't it be nice if we were going to take care of the injured people that maybe the injured party could get 70% instead of only 47%? You know, that might be worth working on. But, you know, but please ask the questions. Let us work on you between now and the session starts. We feel very lucky that you folks are willing to take the time, and we sincerely thank you, Senator Taylor, to continue the dialogue on tort reform in the state. Thank you, sir.
Let me give you some feel we ended up using MICA. MICA was created by the state legislature with a grant of $10 capital. We conveyed to MICA a letter written to the insurance commission. We actually loaned up at the end of about a 13-year career. Now, the reason we set them up is they would sell insurance at a decent rates to doctors and sort of protect our doctors and hospitals. We created our own. Anybody in the private sector would be trying to do that, violating various insurance laws. So we, the state, did it because our doctors were in distress. Except they would pay at. We also did one other thing. We required every single licensed doctor and hospital in the state to buy insurance through that agency so we'd have a broad enough. What was the very first thing that the medical profession did to help us out after helping them? They sued us. They sued us to break MICA because good old Piece of the Rock had come in through the back door and now was offering premiums lower than MICA. So all the good docs that could get cheap insurance from somebody else bailed out of MICA. Who were we left with? Every hospital and doctor in the state that couldn't get cheap insurance. So we get the worst of the batch. At the end of 10 years, we brought the MICA fiduciary committee, and we asked them, I personally asked the question, how many lawsuits have you lost? The answer was none. They'd not lost one single lawsuit in 10 years. What has been your average claim that you have settled in your 10 years of experience? $70,000, average claim. How much do you have in reserves? They had over $21 million in reserves, and they'd already sent out a surcharge to all of our doctors and hospitals in the state that they covered, 40% surcharge, because their offshore reinsurance carrier said they wanted that much money. When we calculated that out, they had better than half a million dollars in reserve every single pending claim, and their average previous 10 years meant they had settled all those claims less than 70. So what had we done? We created an insurance pool for the docs because they were in such tough shape. We insured people that nobody else would insure at a rate less than they would insure. And at the end of 13 years, we had $7+ million in profit. That isn't a business that I find going into. Start off with a government loan and have a $7 million profit because, you see, MICA paid the state of Alaska back its loan plus interest. So the actual profit was somewhere in the neighborhood of $12-$13 million. Why'd they go out of business? Because people are going to have to pay taxes on it. And I don't want there to be any misunderstanding of what occurred with MICA, because Al was there, I was there, and Mike was there. We all got people coming up down the halls. All the very same doctors that were talking about tort reform were the ones coming saying, oh, please, get rid of MICA, because I'll have to pay personal income tax on that amount of money that I've made off of malpractice coverage last summer. And any attempt that we ever do to start another insurance pool in this state to once again get our doctors and hospitals back to some sort of reasonable coverage, like you had to, Kay, go into the market and bid it, to get you that 25 or 30% drop you should have had out of MICA in the first place, or NorCal now, you watch the insurance industry inundate legislative halls if we ever try to create another save our doctors again. But some of us have been there just a little too long. See, we can remember. Maybe that's why they want term limits, yeah. I guess the question I had is, you're talking about claims made versus occurrence. Don't you buy a tail? Everybody that I know that's got claims made coverage, you buy a tail. So it's exactly the same coverage as occurrence coverage. You're just paying for two lumps instead of one. They found a way to nail you twice.
Yes. I think every thinking person buys a tail. And particularly the physician that's going to be in practice for a while, that's built into next year's premium. But you're going to see, because the insurance premiums have leveled, you're going to gradually see as claims made matures, I think it's 6 or 7 years, that tail is going to get more expensive. And if you're a family physician delivering obstetrics in Sitka, Alaska, and you want to retire tomorrow or next year, you know, unless you prepaid that tail, you're going to look at a pretty hefty amount of money to pay to keep the tail. The tails, you've deferred the cost, but you're still going to pay it sooner or later.
I asked Reed if he could get us that site, that case of about 20 years in Indiana. Research we did some 3 or 4 years ago. We couldn't find a case any place in the United States for 8 years. A child was 8 years of age, a suit hadn't been bought. So we felt that was probably good. And in fact, I had sponsored legislation to in an 8-year statute of limitations on the bad baby cases. Your analysis of health care costs would be appreciated as concerns comparing it with the GNP, say the last 10 years. The one cost that we're missing is I'd like to know what the cost of judgments have been during that same period of time. And I'd like to compare the increase in health costs, but the increase in the number of dollars going out for judgments. My personal belief is we're going to find out that the health care cost has outstripped everything else in the American economy as far as cost.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. Occasionally you do break up. Thank you.
No, I know they're not judgments, Kay. What I want is the total cost, because each time that I've met with the health care providers, they talk about how 60% of the dollar is going just to litigation costs and not going to the victim. Well, how much of that is being paid for these very same defense attorneys that we were hearing about from John Holst? And my personal experience has been they won't even talk settlement until the big law firms ginned up somewhere in the neighborhood quarter of $1 million worth of legal fees, and you're about 2 weeks away from the courthouse. Then somebody wants to talk about settling the case where they cut the wrong leg off. You know, prior to that, you had 2 years of huge interrogatories and depositions and the rest of it to go through. So I'd like to see the whole cost. I'd just love sometime to be able to have the defense walk in and be required to tell the jury how much money they've spent on their attorneys in the last 2-3 years. That'd be kind of fun. And we, I think, as a judiciary committee, should have a right to know that and to expect the profession to come forward and say, here's how much money we spend defending costs. I think if you took it across the board, the average cost of defense is probably less the total amount of the settlement finally paid out. Either that or Micah's numbers were all crazy at 70,000. That's right. Micah never lost a suit. And this is apparently in a state that is so anxious for everybody to sue each other, we have to pass laws to preventing doing it. The other question I had for you is, why should we take, give me an example here, structured settlements. I'm going to board a Mark Air airplane. Their driver comes out intoxicated and drives right over me with a little tow truck. Breaks both legs. I'm in the hospital all fouled up. I have huge medical costs getting rebuilt and the rest of it. They refuse to settle. We dance around for 2 years, and finally I get a judgment. I take it clear to the Supreme Court because I'll have to. They won't pay. So we go to the Supremes, and I get a judgment for $1 million. My legs, medical bills, out of the rest of it. And you're telling me, Harlan, that I'd be so much better off to leave that $1 million with Mark Air as opposed to taking it home and just frittering it away myself. That would be a structured settlement. Leaving it.
We just hope you recover, Senator, so that,
well, some that
life around the legislature would be awfully quiet without you. But
why would you ever want to leave your money with the guy that injured?
Okay, but while we're looking at the cost of health care, we can, what is it, we can buy you an annuity that will pay you, with that $1 million, will pay you $40,000, $50,000, $70,000 a year the rest of your life. But we can buy that annuity for maybe $700,000 or $800,000. So we don't have to pay as much money. It's a dollars and cents thing. It's no different than winning the lottery. They don't give you $10 million for winning the lottery. They buy you an annuity that says they're gonna pay you $100,000 a year for the rest of your life. So it's a dollars and cents issue. I got a little bean counter in as what we come to that issue. But really, it's a cheaper way.
But isn't the judgment already reduced to present value?
I don't, sir.
They are. If the judgment has already been factored down and reduced to present value, what it would generate over time, why would I want to give up, as you've just suggested, $200,000 of the billion to which a jury and the Supreme Court has said I'm entitled, so you can go buy the annuity? Heavens. I go buy the annuity and still have the $200,000 left over to buy a nice home?
Yes, you can. Mr. Chairman, I failed, and will come back to you to discuss Section 19 of the bill, which is the Jackson v. Power, which is the liability of a hospital for the actions of an emergency room physician. So that is a very major piece of legislation for hospitals here in the state. And we would like, probably at another hearing, a chance to review that with you.
That's again a question of privilege.
Yes, it is.
Do you think the state medical board should be the one that grants the privilege as opposed to the hospital?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't. I don't think the State Bar Association should be liable for all the actions of all the attorneys in the state. But I think that the hospital should be responsible for the actions of its doctors when that physician is incompetent. In other words, if we allow an individual who's not providing quality care onto our hospital staff, then that hospital should be liable. But as so many times in the liability arena, it is your highly certified, highly competent physician under the stress of a certain procedure makes a very serious mistake, and it's a mistake. It's a physician mistake. It's their responsibility, and the hospital should not be the deep pocket. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. Any further questions? Yes, Senator Adams.
Just one for the record, so it's clear that you made a statement earlier that the House had a great debate on this piece of legislation. If the House voted on that great debate, it wouldn't be sitting here because this bill was debated. Two people in the House of Representatives horse traded, dead horses. One, a resolution on subsistence, and the other one was a teacher tenure bill. So if we went and voted on a debate, it wouldn't be sitting here today. So I just want to clarify that for the public that's listening to this.
Thank you, Senator Adams.
Please pardon the interruption. Juno is unable to hear Sitka. Is there testifying going on in Sitka?
Sorry. Without tort reform, there will be even greater disenchantment with our judicial system. Each branch of our government, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial, must represent the people with justice and equity, or we have no effective government. Tort reform is an idea whose time has come, and we urge you to support it. Thank you.
Among your membership, back.
Certainly.
I'd like to know of any outrageous, unfair business people sick of the has occurred in their here. I don't want to hear the anecdotal story about some guy having a heart attack by yanking on his lawnmower in Albuquerque and how he got $2 billion. Most of the time we check those things out. But I would love to hear from core membership. Maybe you could have a luncheon or something and say, hey, you've been nailed on a bad one, and why was it bad? And then if you could, I'd like to get copies of that judgment to find out what the factual case was so we can see. We have outrageous, unfair civil awards on it, Sitka.
I think it's more a matter of the insurance premium costs are high because it's across the board. That every business owner has to have high insurance coverage for the very possibility that something can happen. And you know, it's like if you're a commercial real estate appraiser, you may have $1 million errors and omission insurance. But, and of that, you have to carry that, and that's a very high premium. You have to carry that because if a real estate agent makes an error on selling a piece of property and you have appraised it, then they're going to come after everybody that's ever had anything to do with that piece of property, including the bank, which that raises your premium costs all across every business owner, whether or not they are individually attacked by a frivolous suit or even a real suit. The costs are spread such by the insurance companies that all pay. But I will do what you ask.
Let me follow that up, because I think you've made a very good point. I agree with you that the premiums are, I think, outrageous. But outrageous not so much because they're so high, but because I can never find any justification when I go back through the insurance commissioner's office and ask him why he approves such an outrageous premium. He says, well, they have to make sure they make a profit. So it's not always trying to make a profit and carry them on our backs. I was at a national conference just a week ago where a speaker on tort reform alleged that in his community, he had a small town back east, he had a doctor that had practiced medicine for 30 years. He delivered babies. He had never had a claim filed against him in 30 years. Not so much as a claim, but a suit. And he was having to pay $100,000.
That's exactly.
Sure like somebody to be able to explain to that doctor why he should have to pay, what kind of risk he is with a 30-year track record. He should have to pay a $100,000 premium. Why don't we have a piece of the rock sitting here in front of us? Their charts out. Let's let them explain to that doctor. Instead, the doctor, he says, keep those people from suing me. I hear they're suing all over the country. Have you ever been sued? No. Have lawsuits, Pete, gone up in Sitka civil litigation? Is it a higher percentage of the calendar today than it was 24 years ago? I don't either, and I'd really like to have that information. I think it might be eye-opening for all of us. But if you could check on that, Don, I'd really appreciate it.
Be glad to do that. Thank you.
My name is Richard Rogers, and I'm here to speak as a private citizen on tort reform. I believe that the time for tort reform has come. The bill that's out there, I support most of it in theory, but I do have a couple of questions for you, if that's all right. I'm not sure. On the limitations that said there, the $300,000 and $500,000, much like Pete referred to, I'm not sure if I agree with that, if that's the correct amount or not, but I support limitations. The other question I have is on the statute of limitations, the 8-year statute of limitations. It's not clear to me if, let's say, I was in a construction job or something like that, or working for the military or something, and they were doing some kind of test, and 20 years later I found out I got cancer from that. Is that statute of limitations apply here? Is that 8 year?
Sir Richard, the 8 years we were talking about was specifically dealing with the question child's years of minority.
Just a child.
Right. Normally on say you're doing, you've had a surgery and 5 years later you discover they left a set of scissors or something inside of you. It's from the date of discovery that the 2-year statute is.
Okay.
So I don't know how that might apply specifically. I think if in fact it's an activity that occurred during a period of time when you were enlisted in the armed services, that's controlled by a different series of laws, all of them federal, and they're under the Federal Tort Claims Act. I'm not familiar enough.
I just use that as an example. I'm not applying it to myself.
Sure. Right ahead.
The other question would be on the, and I don't have the papers in front of me, but for a lawsuit, if they were to settle outside of court prior to, and then they go into court, and they settled for less than what was offered outside of court. It stated that the individual would have to pay the attorney's fees and everything to the losing side. Basically, if I offered you $200,000, you said, no, let's go to court, and you got $180,000, then I'd be liable for the attorney's fees. Is that my understanding?
Existing law today.
That's existing law. So I could go in and say, no, I won't settle for $200,000, and I win in court but only get $199,000 and end up paying maybe $60,000 in attorney's fees.
That's correct. That's existing law and conference judgment. In fact, that's considered major tort reform in most of the other states. Oregon debated it significantly this year. I don't think they passed it. It's called loser pays. We've had it since we became a state. And in fact, every bill that's come through the legislature in the last 11 years, calling itself tort reform, attempted to get rid of Rule 82. Rule 82 is the rule that says, if you sue me, and I will, you pay my cost. Loser pays. Other states are now attempting to adopt this, and this is the first tort reform bill I've seen where the insurance industry didn't try to throw it out. They, of course, want to throw it out because if you've got a whole lot of money in the legal system, all playing at the same card table, and I got a great big pile of money, and you got a little pile of money, I can go to court with you and play games with you for the next 10 years. I'll bankrupt you. And at the end of it, you receive a judgment of $20,000, and you've already spent $50,000 in attorney's fees just to keep up with the fast horses I ran up here. That became so flagrant in Oregon with particular insurance companies that the companies were writing letters back on fender benders, $5,000 and less. This is in the mid-60s. And the letter said, go ahead and sue us. By the time you get done in court, it'll cost you more in attorney's fees than the $5,000, so we refuse to settle with you on any basis. That was routine. The state of Oregon legislature had to then pass a law that said if your damages were under a certain amount and they failed to settle with you in a given period of time and you prevailed at trial, you got double your money. That's the only way they could straighten these guys up. Apple.
Yeah. As I said,
We've got it right now. Okay. So you already have the benefit of offers of judgment and pleading to, which many other states have.
As I said, I am in favor of tort reform. It's just the bill is unclear to me in some areas, and maybe it was that way, and so it would take longer to get through. I don't know. But it's unclear to me that everybody will agree on this and they will pass this year. I certainly hope it, some modified form of it passes. The question about structured payment, I'm not sure that I agree with that. I suspect that it would be far better if there was a limitation on the size of the settlement before they put the structured payment in place. Like you said, I don't know if you'd want your money invested in Marcare or not, but there are other ways of doing that. If the amount is, I'm not going to set an amount, but when we're over a certain amount, maybe structured payments would be the best way to go. But when you're talking about somebody who's disabled, structured payments don't do them a lot of good when they have to wait every year for something to come out.
It'd be nice if we could structure the economy so there'd be no inflation.
The other thing is I feel that the lawsuits are getting out of hand, and tort reform is going to solve that problem to a degree. And here right now, if we weren't all sensible people, we are, if one of us fell over in here because of the heat and hit our head, in some other community, we probably have a lawsuit on our hand, but in here, I'm sure one of us would come and pick each other up. And I think most people in the world are common sense people, but I encourage you to vote and pass this in some positive form.
Thank you.
Question?
Thanks again. Paula, you're up.
Yeah, Senator Taylor?
Yes.
Yeah, I hate to interrupt, but I just want to make sure you got the word. We do have a couple of folks standing by in Ketchikan to testify when you get to them.
Yes, understood. We're just about done here in Sitka. Let's go down to Ketchikan next.
Thank you, sir.
Raise your right hand. I swear to tell the truth. Thank you. Paula Scott.
Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Paula Scott, and I hesitate to tell you I'm an insurance broker. Hopefully you won't hold that against me. But I'm here to urge your support as a member of the general public. I'm not an expert on our judicial system, and I'm not an expert on tort reform, but I believe that tort reform should include the following provisions. I believe in a limit on non-economic damages, such as pain and suffering. I think evidence of collateral benefits received by the claimant should be presented to the jury. I think punitive damages should be awarded only for punishment of a malicious and intentional act. And I think punitive damages should be awarded by a preset multiple of the actual damages. I think the system on how to arrive at the, some of those punitive damages. I think Alaskans have the right to recover costs and damages in civil suits, but I think Alaskans have the rights to be protected from unreasonable court settlements. Thank you.
Trying to write notes. You said limit on non-economic damages, collateral source supplied to jury?
Correct.
Was the next one punitive, or did I miss one?
No, punitive is the next, correct.
And you want punitive multiplied by some fact relative to actual damages? When collateral, the collateral source thing that's got in here right now is different, I think, what you said.
Well, the way that I read that, the collateral source would be that it, it that information would be presented to the jury, and that the jury could then subtract the amount of the collateral benefits from the actual settlement, plus the let's say it was an auto insurance company, they would not then have the right to subrogate against the claimant to recover those damages, correct?
Let me give you an example and see if you think this is up to beats. You're sitting at the stop sign up here, and a truck full of travel smacks into the back of your car. It destroys your car. You have major medical damages. You've been good. That make any sense? Shouldn't you and your carrier pay the money since you didn't do anything? Why shouldn't your carrier be able to turn to that person and say, look, we paid